just Krungtep. The sound of scuffling comes from outside. A pair of men stand in the broken doorway with their spring guns drawn.
Hold!
Jaidi grimaces, clasps the file behind his back.
Yes? There is a difficulty?
The guard stepped through the door, surveyed the office.
Who are you?
Jaidi looks at Somchai.
I thought you said I was famous.
Somchai shrugs.
Not everyone loves Muay Thai.
But still,
everyone gambles.
They should have at least placed bets on my fights.
The guards come closer. They order Jaidi and Somchai onto their knees. As the guards come around to secure them, Jaidi lashes out with an elbow, catches one guard in the gut, whirls with a knee that slams the man in the head. The other guard fires a stream of blades before Somchai hits him in the throat. The man falls, dropping his pistol, gurgling through a broken windpipe. Jaidi grabs the surviving guard, drags him close.
Do you know this man?
He holds up the picture of his target. The guard's eyes widen and he shakes his head, tries to crawl away towards his pistol. Jaidi kicks it out of reach, then kicks the man in his ribs.
Tell me everything about him. He's yours. Akaratz.
The guard shakes his head.
No!
Jaidi kicks him in the face, drawing blood. Gets down beside the mewling man.
Tell me!
Or you follow your friend.
Both their eyes travel to the gurgling man, strangling on his own crushed airway.
Tell me,
Jaidi says.
No need for that.
At the door, the object of Jaidi's hunger stands. Men pour in through the door ahead of him. Jaidi draws his pistol, but they fire and blades slash into his gun arm. He drops the pistol, blood pours. He turns to run for the office's windows, but men tackle him, skidding on the wet marble. Everyone goes down in a tangle of limbs. Somewhere far away, Jaidi hears Somchai bellowing. His arms are yanked behind him. Zip straps bind his wrists in rattan bonds.
Tourniquet that, the man orders. I don't want him bleeding to death.
Jaidi looks down. Blood is welling out of his arm. His captors stanch the flow. He's not sure if he's lightheaded from blood loss or the sudden lust he has for his enemy's death. They yank him upright. Somchai joins him, his nose pouring blood, his eye closed, teeth red. Behind him on the floor, two men lie still. The man studies the two of them. Jaidi returns the gaze, refusing to look away.
Captain Jaidi, you were supposed to have entered the monkhood.
Jaidi tries to shrug.
My kuti didn't have enough light. I thought I'd do my penance here instead.
The man smiles slightly.
We can arrange that.
He nods to his men.
Take them upstairs.
The men yank him and Somchai out of the room, drag them down the corridor. They reach an elevator, a real electric elevator, with dials that glow and designs of the ramekin on the walls, each button a small demon's mouth, and busty women playing Sa Duang and Jaka around the edges. The doors close.
What is your name?
Jaidi asks the man. The man shrugs. It's not important.
You're Akarat's creature.
The man doesn't answer. The doors open. They come out on the roof. 15 stories into the air. The men shove him and Somchai toward the lip of the building.
"Go on," says the man.
"You wait up here, over by the edge, where we can see you." They point their spring guns and order him forward until he and Somchai stand at the lip, looking down on the faint glows of the methane lamps. Jaidi studies the plunge. "So this is what it is to face death." He stares down into the depths, the street far below, the air waiting for him.
"What did you do with Chaya?"
He calls back to the man. The man smiles.
"Is that why you are here?
Because we didn't return her to you soon enough?" Jaidi feels a thrill of hope. Could he have been wrong?
"You can do what you want with me, but let her go."
The man seems to falter. Is it guilt that makes him hesitate? Jaidi cannot tell. He is too far away. Is Chaya dead then for certain?
"Just let her go. Do what you want with me."
The man doesn't say anything. Jaidi wonders if there is anything he should have done differently. It was brash of him to come here, but she was lost already. And the man has made no promises, no taunts to suggest she is alive. Was he foolish?
"Is she alive or not?"
he asks. The man smiles slightly. "I suppose it hurts not to know."
"Let her go."
It wasn't personal, Jaidi. If there had been another way. The man shrugs. She is dead. Jaidi is sure of it. All part of some plan. He shouldn't have let Pracha convince him otherwise. He should have attacked immediately with the full power of his men, taught Trade a lesson in retribution. He turns to Somchai. "I'm sorry about this." Somchai shrugs. "You were always a tiger. It's in your nature. I knew that when I came with you. Still, Somchai, if we die here..." Somchai smiles. "Then you will come back as a Cheshire." Jaidi can't help a bark of surprised laughter. It feels good, this bubbling noise. He finds he can't stop. The laughter fills him up, lifting him. Even the guards snicker. Jaidi catches another glimpse of Somchai's widening smile, and his mirth redoubles. Behind them, footsteps. A voice. Such a humorous party. So much laughter for a pair of thieves. Jaidi can barely master himself. He gasps for breath.
"There must be a mistake. We just work here." "I think not."
"Turn around." Jaidi turns. The trade minister stands before him, Akarat in the flesh. And beside him, Jaidi's hilarity leaves him like hydrogen gusting from a dirigible. Akarat is flanked by bodyguards. Black Panthers. Royal elites. A sign of the palace's esteem to have them on his leash. Jaidi's heart goes cold. No one in the environment ministry is so protected. Not even General Pracha himself. Akarat smiles slightly at Jaidi's shock. He surveys Jaidi and Somchai as though examining tilapia in the market, but Jaidi does not care. His eyes are on the nameless man behind him. The unassuming one. The one. Puzzle pieces click into place. "You're not Trade at all," he murmurs. "You're with the palace." The man shrugs. Akarat speaks. "You're not so bold now, are you, Captain Jaidi? There, I told you were famous." Somchai murmurs. Jaidi almost laughs again, though the implications of this new understanding are deeply troubling. "You truly have the palace's backing?" Akarat shrugs. "Trade is in ascendancy. The Somdet Chalpraya favors an open policy." Jaidi measures the distance between them. Too far. "I'm surprised a Hia like you would dare come so close to your dirty work." Akarat smiles. "I wouldn't miss this. You've been an expensive thorn." "Do you intend to push us yourself, then?" Jaidi taunts. "Will you stain your own kama with my death here?" He nods at the men around them. "Or will you try to put the stain on your men? See them come back as cockroaches in their next life, to be squashed 10,000 times before a decent rebirth. Blood on their hands for killing in cold blood. For the sake of profit?" The men shift nervously and glance at one another. Akarat scowls. "You're the one who will come back as a cockroach." Jaidi grins. "Come then. Prove your manhood. Push the defenseless man to his death." Akarat hesitates. "Are you a paper tiger?" Jaidi goads. "Come on then, hurry up. I'm getting dizzy waiting so close to the edge." Akarat studies him. "You've gone too far, White Shirt. This time you've gone too far." He strides forward. Jaidi whirls. His knee rises, slams into the Trade Minister's ribs. The men are all shouting. Jaidi leaps again, moving as smoothly as he ever did in the stadiums. It's almost as though he never left Lumpini. Never left the crowds and the roar of gamblers. His knee crushes the Trade Minister's leg. Fire crackles in Jaidi's joints, unused to these contortions. But even with his hands tied behind his back, his knees still fly with the efficiency of a champion's. He kicks again. The Trade Minister grunts and stumbles to the building's edge. Jaidi raises his foot to drive Akarat over the precipice, but pain blossoms in his back. He stumbles. Blood mists in the air. Spring gun discs rip through him. Jaidi loses his rhythm. The building's edge surges toward him. He glimpses Black Panthers grabbing their patron, yanking him away. Jaidi kicks again, trying for a lucky strike. But he hears the whine of more blades in the air. The whir of pistol springs unwinding as they spit discs into his flesh. The blooms of pain are hot and deep. He slams against the edge of the building, falls to his knees. He tries to rise again, but now the spring gun whine is steady. Many men firing. The high-pitched squeal of releasing energy fills his ears. He can't get his legs under him. Akarat is wiping blood off his face. Somchai is struggling with another pair of panthers. Jaidi doesn't even feel the shove that sends him over the edge. The fall is shorter than he expected. Chapter 18. The rumor travels like fire in the dead timber of Isan. The tiger is dead. Trade is in ascendancy for certain. Hak Sung's neck prickles as tension blossoms in the city. The man who sells a newspaper to him does not smile. A pair of white shirts on patrol scowls at every pedestrian. The people who sell vegetables seem suddenly furtive, as if they are dealing contraband. The tiger is dead, shamed somehow, though no one seems to know the specifics. Was he truly unmanned? Was his head truly mounted in front of the Environment Ministry as a warning to the white shirts? It makes Hak Sung want to gather his money and flee, but the blueprints in the safe keep him bound to his desk. He hasn't felt undercurrents like this since the incident. He stands and goes to the office shutters, peers out to the street, goes back to his treadle computer. A minute later, he moves to the factory's observation window to study the ties working on the lines. It's as if the air is charged with lightning. A storm is coming, full of waterspouts and tidal waves. Hazards outside the factory and hazards within. Halfway into the shift, Mai came again, shoulders slumped. Another sick worker, sent off to a third hospital. Sukhumvit this time. And down below, at the heart of the manufacturing system, something foul reaches for them all. Hak Sung's skin crawls at the thought of disease brewing in those vats. Three is too many for coincidence. If there are three, then there will be more. Unless he reports the problem. But if he reports anything, the white shirts will burn the factory to the ground, and Mr. Lake's Kingspring plans will go back across the seas, and everything will be lost. A knock comes on the door.
Lai.
Mai slips into the room, looking frightened and miserable. Her black hair is disarrayed. Her dark eyes scan the room, looking for signs of the Farang.
He's gone to his lunch,
Hak Sung supplies.
Did you deliver the other?
Mai nods.
No one saw me drop her.
Good. That's something.
Mai gives him a miserable whine of acknowledgement.
Yes, what is it?
She hesitates.
There are white shirts about, many of them. I saw them at the intersections all the way to the hospital.
Did they stop you, question you?
No, but there are a lot of them, more than usual, and they seem angry.
It is the tiger and trade, that is all. It can't be us. They don't know about us.
She nods doubtfully but does not leave.
It is difficult for me to work here, she says. It's too dangerous now. The sickness.
She stumbles on her words, finally says,
I'm very sorry. If I'm dead.
She trails off.
I'm very sorry.
Hak Sung nods sympathetically.
Yes, of course. You do no good for yourself if you are sick.
Privately, though, he wonders what safety she can really find. Nightmares of the yellow card slum tower still wake him at night, shaking and grateful for what he has. The towers have their own diseases. Poverty is its own killer. He grimaces, wondering how he himself would balance the terrors of some unknown sickness against the certainty of work. No, this work is not a certainty. This is the same thinking that caused him to leave Malaya too late. His unwillingness to accept that a clipper ship was sinking and to abandon it when his head was still above the waves. Mai is wise where he is dull. He nods sharply.
Yes, of course. You should go. You have youth. You are Thai. Something will come to you.
He forces a smile.
Something good.
She hesitates.
Yes, he asks.
I hoped I could have my last pay.
Of course.
Hak Sung goes to the petty cash safe, swings it open, reaches in and pulls out a handful of red paper. In a fit of reckless generosity that he doesn't quite understand himself, he hands the entire wad over to her.
Here, take this.
She gasps at the amount.
Kun, thank you.
She whines.
Thank you.
It's nothing. Save it. Be careful with it.
A shout rises from the factory floor, then more shouts. Hak Sung feels a surge of panic. The manufacturing line stalls. The stop bell rings belatedly. Hak Sung rushes to the door, looks down at lines. Ploy is waving her hand toward the gates. Others are abandoning their posts, running to the doors. Hak Sung cranes his neck, seeking the cause.
What is it?
Mai asks.
I can't tell.
He turns and runs to the shutters, yanks them open. White shirts fill the avenue, marching in ordered ranks. He sucks in his breath.
White shirts!
Are they coming here?
Hak Sung doesn't answer. He looks over his shoulder at the safe.
With a little time.
No, he's being a fool. He waited too long in Malaya. He won't make the same mistake twice. He goes to the petty cash safe and begins pulling out all the remaining cash, stuffing it into a sack.
Are they coming because of the Sikh?
Mai asks. Hak Sung shakes his head.
It doesn't matter. Come here.
He goes to another window and opens the shutters, revealing the blaze of the factory rooftop. Mai peers out over hot tiles.
What's this?
An escape route. Yellow cards always prepare for the worst.
He smiles as he hoists her up.
We are paranoid, you know.
Chapter 19. You emphasized to Akarat that this was a time-sensitive offer? Anderson asks. What are you complaining about?
Carlyle toasts Anderson over a warm glass of rice beer.
He hasn't had you ripped apart by megadots. I can put resources in his hands. And we aren't asking for much in return. Not by historical standards. Things are going his way. He might not think he needs you. Not with the white shirts bowing and scraping. He hasn't had this much influence since before the December 12th debacle.
Anderson makes a face of irritation. He reaches for his drink, then sets it back. He doesn't want more warm booze. Between the swelter of the day and the Sato, his mind is already dumb and clouded. He's starting to suspect that Sir Francis is trying to drive Farang away, slowly whittling them down with empty promises and warm whiskey.
No ice today, so sorry.
Around the open bar, the few other patrons all look as heat-stunned as he is.
You should have joined up when I first offered.
Carlyle observes.
You wouldn't be stewing now.
When you first offered, you were a blowhard who just lost an entire dirigible. Carlyle laughs.
Missed the big picture on that one, didn't you?
Anderson doesn't respond to the man's needling. It's annoying to have Akarat dismiss the offer of support so easily, but the truth is Anderson can barely focus on his job. Emiko fills his thoughts, and his time. Every night he seeks her out at Planchette, monopolizes her, rains bot on her. Even with Raleigh's greed, the wind-up's company is cheap. In a few more hours, the sun will sink and she will once again totter up on stage. The first time he saw her perform, she caught him watching, and her eyes had clutched at him, begging to be saved from what was about to occur.
"My body is not mine," she told him.
Her voice flat when he asked about the performances.
"The men who designed me, they make me do things I cannot control, as if their hands are inside me. Like a puppet, yes."
Her fists clenched, opening and closing unconsciously, but her voice remained subdued.
"They made me obedient in all ways."
And then she had smiled prettily and flowed into his arms, as if she had made no complaint at all. She is an animal, servile as a dog, and yet, if he is careful to make no demands, to leave the air between them open, another version of the wind-up girl emerges, as precious and rare as a living bow tree. Her soul, emerging from within the strangling strands of her engineered DNA. He wonders if she were a real person, if he would feel more incensed at the abuse she suffers. It's an odd thing, being with a manufactured creature, built and trained to serve. She herself admits that her soul wars with itself, that she does not rightly know which parts of her are hers alone and which have been inbuilt genetically. Does her eagerness to serve come from some portion of canine DNA that makes her always assume that natural people outrank her for pack loyalty? Or is it simply the training that she has spoken of? The sound of marching boots intrudes in Anderson's thoughts. Carlow straightens from his slump, craning for a view of the commotion. Anderson turns and nearly knocks over his beer. White uniforms fill the street. Pedestrians and bicycles and food carts are scattering aside, frantically piling against the walls of rubble and factories, making way for the Environment Ministry's troops. Anderson cranes his neck. Spring rifles and black batons and gleaming white uniforms as far as he can see. A streaming dragon of determination marching past. The resolute face of a nation that has never been conquered. "Jesus and Noah," Carlyle mutters. Anderson watches carefully. That's a lot of white shirts. At some unknown signal, two of the white shirts peel away from the main group and enter Sir Francis's. They survey the Farang lying stupid in the heat with barely masked disgust. Sir Francis, normally so absent and unconcerned, bustles out and whies deeply to the men. Anderson jerks his head toward the door. "Time to go, you think?" Carlyle gives a grim nod. "Let's not be too obvious, though.
A little late for that. You think they're looking for you?"
Carlyle's face is tight.
"I was actually hoping it was you they were after."
Sir Francis finishes speaking with the white shirts. He turns and calls out to his patrons.
"So sorry. We are closed now. Everything is closed. You must leave immediately."
Anderson and Carlyle both sway to their feet.
"I shouldn't have drunk so much,"
Carlyle mutters. They stumble outside with the other bar patrons. Everyone stands under the blazing sun, blinking stupidly as more white shirts stream by. The thud of bootfalls fills the air, echoes from the walls, thrums with the promise of violence. Anderson leans close to Carlyle's ear.
"This isn't another of Akarat's manipulations, I don't suppose. Not like your lost dirigible or anything?"
Carlyle doesn't answer, but the grim expression on his face tells Anderson everything he needs to know. Hundreds of white shirts fill the street, and more keep coming. The uniformed river is unending. They have to be pulling troops in from the countryside.
There's no way this many white shirts work in the city. They're the ministry's front line. For the burnings. Carlisle says, for when sibiscosis or poultry flu gets out of hand.
He starts to point, then drops his hand, not wanting to draw attention to them. Nods instead.
See the badge? The tiger and the torch? They're practically a suicide division. That's where the Tiger of Bangkok got his start.
Anderson nods grimly. It's one thing to complain about the white shirts, to joke about their stupidity and hunger for bribes. It's another to watch them march by in shining ranks. The ground shakes with tramping feet. Dust rises. The street reverberates with their increasing number. Anderson has an almost uncontrollable urge to flee. They are predators. He is prey.
He wonders if Peters and Lay had even this much warning before Finland went wrong.
You have a gun?
He asks Carlisle.
Carlisle shakes his head.
More trouble than they're worth.
Anderson scans the street for Lao Gu.
My rickshaw man's gone missing.
Goddamn yellow cards.
Carlisle laughs quietly.
Always got their fingers to the wind. I'll bet there's not a yellow card in the city who's not in hiding right now.
Anderson grips Carlisle's elbow.
Come on, try not to draw attention to yourself.
Where are we going?
To put our own fingers to the wind. See what's happening.
Anderson leads him down a side street, aiming for the main freight klong, the canal that leads to the sea. Almost immediately they run into a cordon of white shirts. The guards lift their spring rifles and wave Anderson and Carlisle away.
I think they're securing the whole district,
Anderson says.
The locks, the factories.
Quarantine?
They'd have masks if they were here to burn.
A coup, then? Another December 12th?
Anderson glances at Carlisle.
A bit ahead of schedule for that, aren't you?
Carlisle eyes the white shirts.
Maybe General Procha has gotten the jump on us.
Anderson tugs him in the opposite direction.
Come on. We'll go to my factory. Maybe Hak Sung knows something.
All along the street, white shirts are busily rousting people from their shops, encouraging them to close their doors. The last of the shopkeepers are shoving wooden panels into sockets and sealing their storefronts. Another company of white shirts marches by. Anderson and Carlisle arrive at the Spring Life factory in time to see megadonts streaming out of the main gates. Anderson snags one of the megadont men. The Mahout switches his beast to halt and regards Anderson as the megadont snorts and shuffles its feet impatiently. Line workers stream around their obstruction.
Where's Hak Sung?
Anderson asks.
Yellow card, boss. Where?
The man shakes his head.
More workers are hurrying out. Did the white shirts come here?
He asks. The man says something too fast for Anderson to pick up. Carlisle translates.
He says the white shirts are coming for revenge, coming to get back their face.
The man motions emphatically and Anderson steps out of the way. Across the street, the Chow Joe factory is also evacuating its workers. None of the street storefronts are open now. Food carts have all been dragged indoors or wheeled away in fright. Every door on the street is shut. A few ties peer out from high windows, but the street itself contains only dispersing workers and marching white shirts. The last of the Spring Life workers hurry past, none of them looking at Carlisle or Lake as they flee.
Worse by the minute,
Carlisle mutters. His face has gone pale under his tropical tan. A new wave of white shirts rounds the corner, six wide, a snake extending down the length of the street. Anderson's skin prickles at the sight of the closed shop fronts. It's as if everyone is preparing for a typhoon.
Let's make like the natives and get inside.
He grabs one of the heavy iron gates and hauls against it,
Help me! It takes them both to drag the gates closed and set the crossbars.
Anderson slaps locks into place and leans against hot iron, panting. Carlyle studies the bars.
Does this mean we're safe? Or trapped?
We're not in Klongprim prison yet, so let's assume we're winning. But inwardly, Anderson wonders. There are too many variables in play, and it makes him nervous. He remembers a time in Missouri when the Grahamites rioted. There had been tension, some small speeches, and then it had simply erupted in field burning.
No one had seen the violence coming. Not a single intelligence officer had anticipated the cauldron boiling beneath the surface.
Anderson had ended up perched atop a grain silo, choking on the smoke of high-growth fields going up in sheets of flame, firing steadily at rioters on the ground with a spring rifle he'd salvaged from a slow-moving security guard, and all the while he had wondered how everyone had missed the signs. They lost the facility because of that blindness. And now it is the same. A sudden eruption, and the surprise of realizing that the world he understands is not the one he actually inhabits.
Is this Pracha making a play for absolute power? Or Akarat causing more trouble?
Or is it simply a new plague? It could be anything.
As Anderson watches White Shirt stream past, he could almost smell the smoke of burning silos in Hygro.
He waves Carlyle into the factory. Let's find Haksang. If anyone knows anything, it will be him.
Upstairs, the administrative offices are empty. Haksang's incense burns steadily, sending up gray silk streamers. Papers lie abandoned on his desk, rustling under the gentle breeze of the crank fans.
Carlyle laughs, low and cynical.
Lost an assistant?
Looks that way.
The petty cash safe is unlocked. Anderson peers at the shelves. At least 30,000 baht gone missing.
Goddamn! The bastard robbed me!
Carlyle pushes open a shutter, revealing roof tiles stretching down the length of the factory.
Take a look at this.
Anderson frowns.
He was always messing with the latches on that one. I thought he wanted to keep people out.
I think he's ducked out of it instead.
Carlyle laughs.
You should have fired him when you had a chance.
The tramp of more boots on cobbles echoes up to them, the only sound now in the street.
Well, give him points for foresight.
You know what the Thais say? When a yellow card runs, watch out for the megadot behind him.
Anderson surveys the offices one last time, then leans out the window.
Come on! Let's see where my assistant went.
You serious?
If he didn't want to meet the White Shirts, then we don't either. And he obviously had a plan.
Anderson hoists himself up and climbs out into the sun. His hands burn on the tiles. He straightens, shaking them. It's like standing on a skillet. He studies the roof, breathing shallowly in the blast furnace heat. Down the length of the roof, the Chow Joe factory beckons. Anderson goes a few paces, then turns and calls back.
Yeah, I think he went this way.
Carlyle climbs out into the roof. Sweat gleams in his face and soaks his shirt. They make their way over reddish tiles as the air boils around them. At the far end of the roof, their route terminates at an alley, shielded from Tanon Posri by a winding of the lane. Across the gap, a ladder dangles to the ground.
I'll be damned.
They both stare down into the alley three stories below.
Your old Chinaman jumped that?
Carlyle asks.
Looks like it.
And then went down the ladder. Anderson peers over the edge.
Long way down.
He can't help smiling darkly at Haksang's resourcefulness.
Sly bastard.
It's a long jump.
Not too bad, and if Haksang...
Anderson doesn't get a chance to finish his sentence. Carlyle flies past him, hurtling across the gap. The man lands hard and hits the roof rolling. A second later, he's up, grinning and waving for Anderson to follow. Anderson scowls and makes his own run at the gap. The landing rattles his teeth. By the time he straightens, Carlyle is already disappearing over the edge, climbing down the ladder. Anderson follows, favoring a bruised knee. Carlyle is surveying the alley when Anderson drops down beside him.
"That way goes back to town on Postery and our friends," Carlyle says. "We don't want that."
Hawksong is paranoid. Anderson says, "He'll have a path worked out, and it won't be on main streets." He heads in the opposite direction. Almost immediately, a slot between two factory walls appears. Carlyle shakes his head in admiration.
"Not bad."
They squeeze into the narrow way, scraping along for more than 100 meters until they reach a door of rusted tin. As they push aside the crude gate, a grandmother looks up from a bundle of washing. They're in a courtyard of sorts. Laundry hangs everywhere, sun pouring a rainbow through damp fabrics. The old woman waves at them to proceed past her. A moment later, they're out in a tiny soy, which in turn gives way to a series of maze-like alleys that twist through a makeshift slum for the coolie laborers who work the levee locks, transporting goods from the factories to the sea. More micro-alleys, laborers crouched over noodles and fried fish, weather-all shacks, sweat and the dimness of overhanging roofs, burning chili smoke that makes them cough and cover their mouths as they forge through the swelter.
"Where the hell are we?"
Carlyle murmurs. "I'm completely turned around." "Does it matter?" They thread past dogs lying dazed in the heat and Cheshires perched atop refuse piles. Sweat runs down Anderson's face. The buzz of afternoon alcohol is long gone. More shadowy alleys, more tight walking spaces, twists and turns, squeezing around bicycles and scavenged piles of metal and coconut plastics. A gap opens. They spill out into diamond sunlight. Anderson sucks at the relatively fresh air, grateful to be out of the claustrophobia of the alleys. It is not a large road, but still, there is traffic on it. Carlyle says,
"I think I recognize this. There's a coffee guy somewhere around here that one of my clerks likes."
"No white shirts, at least."
"I need to find a way back to the Victory," Carlyle says. "I've got money in their safe."
"How much is your head worth?" Carlyle grimaces.
Maybe you're right. I need to get in touch with Akarat at least, find out what's going on, decide on our next move."
Hawksong and Lao Gu both disappeared. Anderson says, "For now, let's make like the yellow cards and lie low. We can take a rickshaw to Sun Kum Vi Klong, and then take a boat to near my place. That will keep us far away from any of the factory and trade areas, and far away from all those damn white shirts." He flags down a rickshaw man, not bothering to bargain as he and Carlyle climb aboard. Away from the white shirts, Anderson can feel himself relaxing, almost feels foolish for his earlier fear. For all he knows, they could have just walked down the street and never been bothered. No need to go running across rooftops at all. Perhaps. He shakes his head frustrated. There's too little information. Hawksong didn't wait, just gathered up the money and ran. Anderson thinks back on the carefully planned escape route again. The jump. He can't help laughing. "What's so funny?" "Just Hawksong. He had it all worked out. Everything set. As soon as there was trouble, shoo! Out the window he goes." Carlyle grins.
"I never knew you were keeping a geriatric ninja."
"I thought..." Anderson breaks off. The traffic is slowing. Up ahead, he catches a glimpse of white and stands for a better view.
Hell.
The starched whites of the Environment Ministry are in the road, blocking traffic. Carlisle pops up beside him.
Checkpoint?
Looks like this isn't just the factories. Anderson glances behind, hunting for a way out, but more people and cyclists are piling up, jamming the way.
Should we make a run for it?
Carlisle asks. Anderson scans the crowd. Beside him, another rickshaw driver stands on his pedal, studying the scene, then settles back on his seat and jangles his passing bell irritably. Their own rickshaw man joins the bell ringing. No one seems worried. Along the road ties barter over piled, reeking durian, baskets of lemongrass, and bubbling buckets of fish. They too seem unconcerned.
You just want to bluff through?
Carlisle asks. Hell if I know. If this is some kind of power play of Pratchett's,
I keep telling you, Pratchett's had his teeth pulled.
Doesn't look like it. Anderson cranes his neck, trying to glimpse what's happening at the roadblock. From what he can make out, someone is arguing with the white shirts, gesturing as he speaks. A Thai man, deep mahogany skin and a flash of gold thumb rings on his hands. Anderson strains to hear, but the words are drowned out as more cyclists pile into the jam and join in the impatient ringing of their bells. The Thais seem to believe this is nothing but an irritating traffic jam. No one is frightened, just impatient. More bicycle bells tinkle and chime, surrounding him in music.
Oh, shit.
Carlisle murmurs. The white shirts yank the arguing man off his bicycle. His arms flail as he goes over. His thumb rings flash in the sunlight, and then he disappears under a knot of white uniforms. Ebony clubs rise and fall. Blood whips from the clubs, glistening. A dog-like yelping fills the street. The cyclists all stop ringing their bells. The street noise fades as everyone turns and cranes their necks to see. In the silence, the man's ragged pleading carries easily. Around them, hundreds of bodies shift and breathe. People glance left and right, suddenly nervous, like an ungulate herd that has suddenly found a predator in its midst. The dull slap of the clubs continues. Finally, the man sobbing breaks off. The white shirts straighten. One of them turns and motions traffic forward. It is an impatient gesture, businesslike, as though the people have stopped to gawk at flowers or a carnival. Hesitantly, cyclists push forward. Traffic begins to roll. Anderson sits down in his seat.
Christ.
Their rickshaw man stands on his own pedals and they start forward. Carlisle's expression has gone tight with anxiety. His eyes flick from left to right.
Last chance to run for it.
Anderson can't take his gaze from the approaching white shirts. Will be obvious if we bolt.
We're fucking Farang. We're already obvious.
Pedestrians and cyclists inch forward, merging through the choke point, shuffling past the carnage. A half dozen white shirts stand around the body. Blood pools from the man's head. Flies already buzz in the red rivulets, sticky winged, drowning in the surfeit of calories. A Cheshire shadow crouches eagerly at the periphery. Blocked from the congealing pool by a white picket barrier of uniformed trouser legs. All the officers' cuffs are spattered red. Dew kisses of kinetic energy absorbed. Anderson stares at the carnage. Carlisle clears his throat nervously. A white shirt glances up at the noise and their eyes lock. Anderson isn't sure how long they stare at one another, but the hate in the officer's eyes is unmistakable. The white shirt raises an eyebrow, challenging. He slaps his club against his leg, leaving a bloody smear. Another slap of the club and the officer jerks his head sideways, indicating that Anderson should look away. Chapter 20. Death is a stage, a transience, a passage to a later life. If Kanya meditates on this idea long enough, she imagines that she will be able to assimilate it. But the truth is that Jaidi is dead, and they will never meet again, and whatever Jaidi earned for his next life, whatever incense and prayers Kanya offers, Jaidi will never be Jaidi. His wife will never be returned, and his two fighting sons can only see that loss and suffering are everywhere. Suffering. Pain is the only truth. But it is better for young ones to laugh a while and feel the softness. And if this desire to coddle a child ties a parent to the wheel of existence, so be it. A child should be indulged. This is what Kanya thinks as she rides her bicycle across the city toward the ministry and the housing that Jaidi's descendants have been placed in. A child should be indulged. The streets are patrolled by white shirts. Thousands of her colleagues out on the street, locking down trade's crown jewels, barely controlling the rage that all in the ministry feel. The fall of the tiger. The slaughter of their father. The living saint fallen. It's as painful as if they had lost Sub Nakasatian again. The environment ministry mourns, and the city will mourn with them. And if all proceeds according to General Pracha's plan, trade and Akarat will mourn as well. Trade has finally overstepped itself. Even Birom Bhakti says that someone must pay for the insult. At the ministry gates, she shows her passes and makes her way into the compound. She cycles down bricked paths between teak and banana trees to the housing quarters. Jaidi's family always kept a modest house. Modest as Jaidi was modest. But now, the last witlings of his family live in something infinitely smaller. A bitter end for a great man. He deserved better than these mildewed concrete barracks. Kanya's own home is much larger than Jaidi's ever was, and she lives alone. Kanya leans her bicycle against a wall and stares up at the barracks. It is one of several the ministry has abandoned. In front of the place, there is a patch of weeds and a broken swing. Not far away is a weedy takraw court for the use of ministry men. At this time of day, no one is playing, and the net hangs limp in the heat. Kanya stands outside the dilapidated building, watching children play. None of them are Jaidis. Surat and Niwat are apparently within, probably already preparing for his funeral urn, calling the monks to chant and help ensure his successful trip into his next incarnation. She takes a breath. An unpleasant task, truly. Why me? She wonders. Why me? Why was I forced to work for a bodhisattva? Why was I the one? She always suspected that Jaidi knew of the extra take she got for herself and the men. But there was always Jaidi. Pure Jaidi. Clear Jaidi. Jaidi did the work because he believed. Not like Kanya. Cynical Kanya. Angry Kanya. Not like the others who did the job because it had the potential to pay well, and a pretty girl might pay attention to a man in dress whites. A man who also had the authority to shut down her pad thai cart. Jaidi fought like a tiger and died like a thief. Dismembered, disemboweled, tossed to dogs and cheshires and crows so that there was little left of him.
Jaidi, with his cock in his mouth and blood in his face, a package delivered to the ministry grounds. An invitation to war. If only the ministry could be sure of its enemy. Everyone whispers trade, but only Kanya knows for certain. She has kept Jaidi's last mission to herself. Kanya burns at the shame of it. She starts up the stairs. Her heart thuds in her chest as she climbs. Why couldn't that damn honorable Jaidi keep his nose out of trade? Take the warning! And now she must visit herself on the sons. Must tell the warrior boys that their father was a good fighter and had a pure heart. And now I must have his equipment. Thank you so much. It is after all the ministries. Kanya raps on the door. Goes back down the steps to give the family time to arrange itself. One of the boys, Surat, she thinks, opens the door, whys deeply to her, calls back inside.
It's Elder Sister Kanya.
Soon Jaidi's mother-in-law is at the door. Kanya whys, and the old woman whys even more in return and lets her in.
I'm sorry to bother you. No bother.
Her eyes are red. The two boys regard her solemnly. Everyone stands uncertainly together. The old woman finally says,
You'll want to collect his things.
Kanya is almost too embarrassed to answer, but she manages to nod. The mother-in-law guides her inside to a sleeping room. It is a sign of the old woman's grief that nothing is in order. The boys watch. The old woman points to a small desk jammed into a corner, a box of his belongings. Files that Jaidi was reading.
That's everything?
Kanya asks. The old woman shrugs dully.
It's what he kept with him after the house was burned. I haven't touched it. He brought it here before he went to the Wat.
Kanya smiles her embarrassment.
Kai, yes, sorry, of course. Why did they do this to him? Hadn't they done enough?
Kanya shrugs helplessly.
I don't know. Will you find them? Will you get revenge on them?
She hesitates. Niwat and Surat watch her solemnly. Their playfulness is entirely gone. They have nothing. Kanya ducks her head wise.
I will find them, I swear it. If it takes me all my life. Do you have to take his things?
Kanya smiles uncertainly.
It's protocol. I should have come before, but...
She trails off helplessly.
We hoped that the tides would turn, that he would be back on the job. If there are private effects on mementos, I will return them, but I need his equipment. Of course, it's valuable.
Kanya nods. She kneels beside the weather-all box of files and gear. It is a careless mangle of files and papers and envelopes and ministry gear. A spare clip of blades for a spring gun, a baton, his zip cuffs, files, all piled together. Kanya imagines Jaidi filling this box. Chaya already lost to him. Everything else soon to be lost. No wonder he didn't bother being careful with any of it. She sifts through the stuff, finds a photograph of Jaidi during his cadet days, standing next to Pracha, both of them looking young and confident. She takes it out, thoughtful, and sets it on the desk. She looks up. The old woman has left the room, but Niwat and Surat are still there, watching her like a pair of crows. She holds out the photo. Finally, Niwat reaches out and takes it, shows it to his brother. Kanya goes through the rest of the box quickly. Everything else seems to be the ministry's. She's obscurely relieved.
She won't have to return then. A small teak box